Session number 24729, real lights.
Mr. Mason, Real 8. We're talking about your time as a squadron navigation officer with 58 Squadron RAF at St. David's. And you said your first flight was, I think, the 13th?
13th, yes. I did one of the patrols, and then on the 19th I did a rover. And on this one we were diverted to look for a U-boat 20 miles northwest of Guernsey, which somebody had seen, and then they'd gone on and we went. And
anything happened? By the way, were you still in Hudson's?
This is Halifax's.
Yes, yes. Could you describe the Halifax? What you thought of the Halifax?
Well, four-engine bomber. Bomber Command, Harris didn't like giving any of his aeroplanes away. But in 1942, he had to give two squadrons to Coastal Command because they were so hard-pressed. And they had Whitleys. Now, the Whitley had gone out of production. It was obsolete. And so he had to replace Whitleys by Halifax. They couldn't do anything about it. So they had these two Halifax squadrons which worked together. One was 58 Squadron, which was an old Bomber Command squadron from the First World War, and 502, which was the auxiliary squadron, the County of Ulster. But they shared an aerodrome, which meant while they were together it made servicing the Halifaxes easier and so on.
What did you think of the Halifax?
Well, it was... It was a very good aircraft because, as opposed to the Lancaster, where you can't walk about upright, Halifax was quite roomy. And, I mean, for Coast Command, it's a great help if you can sort of stand up and move about. And it was well-liked, I think, by the crews.
How did it compare to, say, the Hudson, I mean, for ease of use?
Well, it was very similar in a way. You see, the Hudson was roomy, and the Halifax was. The Lancaster, on the other hand, you know, wherever you are in a Lancaster, there's not a lot of room. But the Halifax, you know, big square-sided fuselage, you've got plenty of room in it.
So what happened next?
And... the point about the Halifax is while they were at St. David's, they alternated between anti-U-boat and anti-shipping, because if there was a at this stage of the war there wasn't much enemy shipping, but you got the odd blockade runners creeping in to the south of France and along the north Spanish coast, and you've got E-boats too. We would attack, and Halifax was handy. You either had depth charges if you were looking for U-boats, or bombs if you're looking. I see, for example, in July I did a rover in the first place. Then the next trip I was looking for an enemy convoy around Brest. And then I had a few days off. I was sent to Tyree, to the Met Squadron, who also had Halifaxes, to do one of their long Met flights and practice Loran. Now, the RAF used G, which was their navigational aid, which was based on, you know, radio stations sending out signals, and you times of the time they got to you, and you had a chart with lines on so that you could plot very quickly where you were.
And that was
G-E-E, which was originally designed for Bomber Command. But it became of more interest to us later. I'm not sure whether at St David's, I don't think we had it. We didn't need it, really. But LORAN was the American equivalent. And LORAN stands for long range. Now, whereas G had a range of something like 300 miles, I think was the maximum, LORAN had a range into thousands. But the only trouble with it was that because you used it over long range, you got signals which had been reflected by the, whatever it was, the troposphere or some sort of sphere. And so you got several lots of signals, so you had to sort them out. Anyway, although on this course at Shawbury, I'd learned all about LORAN, I hadn't actually used it because they didn't have it. And so this was organised for me to actually go on a trip with the Met Squadrons, who went a long way into the Atlantic, and practice using LORAN. And then things went on, same sort of thing.
Did you fly much as, I mean, were you flying as much as the other navigation officers? Now you were squadron navigation officer.
Now, I did the same thing. Having got there as a navigation officer, I didn't fly with a crew, I flew with whoever was short. And I flew with one pod about half a dozen times on the trot. Or more than that. But...
And you had the same role as squadron navigation officer that you had last time?
Yes, but now it was a more official title, as it were, you know, in that... I was a fully qualified, paid-up member.
Had the role changed at all?
Sorry?
Had the role changed at all in the 2 years?
Not really. It was still basically the same requirement. And probably... it probably took up more time. While back in 500 Scotland, it had just been a sort of channel rather than a duty, but now it has become an official, there are more things laid down for you to do, and more things to look after and be responsible for. Anyway, we went on until the 30th of August. We moved from St David's to Stornoway. The invasion was now successful, and the U-boats had pretty well been killed off in the south. In any case, they couldn't come back to their bases. And they were moved up to Norway, so it was logical that they should start moving aircraft up in that direction. And in September, we were engaged in anti-U-boat work. And
this was just patrols in the North Sea?
No. I was looking...
or North Atlantic.
I see the ones in October. We were Bergen up to Kristiansand. Uh, And then, and what I'm trying to find, and I haven't got a date for, is at the end of September, it was decided that we would give up anti-U-boat work and go on to anti-shipping. And so we now went over to bombs completely. And the object was to first to stop shipping between Norway and Germany, particularly, of course, they were reliant on Swedish iron ore, and also to prevent, to some extent, moving equipment and troops from Norway back to Germany. And the area we decided to, or we were told to cover, was between Norway, Sweden and Denmark. And this is the Kattegat. And our patrol normally would be to fly over to the tip of Denmark, then turn down the Kattegat to the bottom, across to the Swedish coast and up to the top. And if we didn't find any ships at sea, we were allowed to look in the nearest Norwegian fjord, provided we didn't drop any bombs on land. We hadn't got to kill any Norwegians, if possible. And I was then crewed up with Wing Commander Grant, the squadron CO.
And what was he like?
He was very good, very conscientious.
What was he like as a bloke, though, you know?
Oh, very nice chap. Very quiet. Subdued sort of fella.
Do you know his first name?
Well, he was known as Mouse, which gives you a clue as to his character. Mouse Grant. Now, he in fact had been shot down by a couple of U-boats, they thought, while we were at St. David's. He was very lucky to get away with it. He homed in on a couple of U-boats in the dark, and before he knew where he was, he was in the sea. But fortunately, after about 9 hours, they were picked up by a destroyer. Which is an interesting point, because again, it just made him a little hesitant, which is why I think I probably lived so long. But having set this up, of course, the thing then, as navigation officer, I had to work out a drill, because obviously the anti-U-boat navigational drill for anti-U-boat patrols would not be suitable for the anti-shipping patrols.
Why not? I'm not quite sure what you mean there.
Well, the Coast Command drill for anti-U-boat patrols, you had to check the wind every 20 minutes and you had to take drifts every so often. You know, it was laid down, you had to have a sort of continual check. Well, if you're going into this enclosed sea, as it were, and you were now a proper observer, because you also dropped the bombs, so you not only got to consider the navigation, you'd also got to look after the bombs and have all the bombing gear under your control.
How did you drop the bombs?
Well, we had to work out some sort of drill, and what we did was we flew about 4,500 feet, and we got radar, of course, which picked up the ships, and we then had G, which meant that you could always check your position with G. And so the important things were, was you flew across from Scotland to the tip of Denmark, and you got a wind at your bombing height so that you would have that to set on your bomb site. You then went along and navigated completely on radar. There's no point in sort of doing a navigational plot on a chart, because you'd got land all round, so you could check your position continually by radar. And there were a couple of islands which you've got to avoid, so that you didn't exactly fly a straight line all the time. And so you navigated the aircraft to Denmark, and then you became a bomb aimer, really, and concentrated on the bombing. So that it was a completely different drill. I worked out a drill with the navigation officer of 502 Squadron, the other squadron, and we put it up to group and said, this is what we're going to do. Well, like all people in comfortable positions, they said, well, we don't like you doing this. This isn't the Coastal Command drill. You can't make up your own drills. We said, well, you know, we're going to do it. And they said, be it on your own heads. And we were very chuffed when about a month or so later in the Coastal Command Review, which was their sort of operational newspaper, they complimented the two squadrons on their navigational ability around the Norwegian fields, so that we didn't hear any more from the group navigation officer. Well, this went fairly well. We
did you ever have cause to drop your bombs?
Oh yes. The way we worked was during the hours of darkness, we sent an aircraft off every half an hour, alternating between the two squadrons, so that if there was a ship about, it got a chance of having bombs dropped on it every half an hour through the night. But you didn't arrive before darkness, and you left before it got light, because there was a fighter aerodrome in the north of Denmark, which had night fighters, and so you would have been mincemeat if you arrived in daylight. So we flew around there, and I know the weather wasn't too bad most of the time, but I have one note here where there were two ships and we couldn't attack them because of the weather. They were in a storm and it was raining, and it was super cold rain. So the minute it hit the aircraft, it formed ice. And we tried from every direction to get at these ships, and every time we got near them, we were covered in ice and had to get out. I remember that quite vividly. The other thing we did was work out a system for what to do when it was cloudy, because they were very anxious that we kept up our patrols as far as possible. So we worked out a system whereby you could drop bombs on a ship without seeing it. What we did was use our radar, and if you if you know the terminal velocity of the bombs, which we did, you can work out the speed at which they'll drop and where they will, if you are at 4,000 feet, work out where they will drop relative to the aircraft. So all you have to do is to work out how to get to the point where you press the button. And we did this by using our radar. If we had a ship on the radar, we would approach it from, say, 5 miles, and the radar operator would call out 4 miles, 3 miles, 2 miles, 1 mile. With a stopwatch, you could check your ground speed on the timing between the miles. Although you'd ask your pilot to, you know, keep on a dead course and the thing. And we worked out a table of how long after the 1 mile you should press the button. So we did this because it kept them very jittery. Even if you didn't hit them, at least kept them on their toes. But it's very interesting. I got a cutting from a Sunday paper here, which said that a ship in a convoy bound for Norway was sunk during an attack by British planes on Friday night. Now, on that night, it so happens there were only two aircraft out, and we both did the same thing. We both dropped bombs through clouds. But which of us it might have been, I don't know. But apparently the ship caught fire and subsequently exploded.
So anything else about this period?
So,
You're flying with Wing Commander Grant most
yes,
of the time.
Yes, yes. I went on flying only with him, really, but...
Any other incidents or any other policies or new techniques?
We flew at about 4,000 feet for a while, and then while we were flying around, we used to see night fighters sometimes, but we started losing aircraft for no apparent reason. And then, through a Bomber Command intelligence summary, we found that this aerodrome in Denmark had got fighters with what they call, the Germans call, jazz music. It was a night fighter, JU-88s usually, with two cannon pointing upwards. They had discovered that if you got underneath a bomber, nobody could see you. And their technique was to get underneath and fire up in between the fuselage and the inboard engines. And you've got a petrol tank there, and so it was pretty immediate. And we got to do something about this. So what we did was fit the aircraft with radio altimeters and fly it 100 feet. We were over the sea, so we weren't likely to hit anything. And when we picked up a ship, we would then climb to about 4,000 feet to drop the bombs and then go down again. And that seemed to settle it. Although occasionally people would be shot down while they were at bombing height. We had one crew land in Sweden. They were attacked while they were bombing a convoy, and you'd always get people be a bit over keen and fly in into the docks. And we saw one of our aircraft shot down one night over the docks, where they ought not to be. Our basic argument was that, you know, if there's nothing at sea tonight, go home and come back tomorrow. But to chase them into the docks was asking for trouble, because they were pretty well protected. So this went on, and the next thing that was interesting that I did was to go to the Dambuster Squadron 617 in Lincolnshire in January 45. They had got a piece of equipment called, what do they call it? The wind-finding attachment. In the aircraft, you had a thing called the air position indicator, and this worked off the direct reading compass and the airspeed. They were fed into this, and you could read off what your air position was, taken from the airspeed and the direction and the course. So that if you went over a pinpoint that you could recognise, you only had to look at the air position indicator to say see what the air position was, and of course you could work out a wind immediately. Bomber Command had a thing called the wind finding attachment, which was attached to the air position indicator and magnified the readings, so that whereas one would normally use it flying along and work out a wind after perhaps a quarter of an hour, 20 minutes or whatever, with the wind finding attachment, which magnified the readings, if you flew over a point and then flew around in a circle for 3 minutes, you could get the wind immediately. And this was very interesting to us, because our biggest problem in attacking a ship was that we didn't know its course and speed. You had to guess them. You could see which way it was going, so you sort of said, well, it's about so and so. The speed, particularly at night, was very hard to guess. Now, if we had this wind-finding attachment, all we had to do was to fly over the ship, fly around for 3 minutes and fly back over it, and you would then have a wind which would incorporate the ship's course and speed. So you would have a relative wind, which you could set on the bomb site, and you got everything in one go. Well, this was the beginning of January. I went to have a look at this bit of equipment, but we never got it. They were very reluctant to give anything away. But we continued going round and round, and I see another attack through cloud on in January, but nothing.
How was morale holding up? Because these anti-shipping operations were.
Sorry.
How was morale in the squadron holding up?
Oh, they were very late. They were very chuffed. Of course, you could, you were seeing things and doing things. Oh, I think they, you know, really felt they were getting somewhere.
So it wasn't like last time when they'd been on anti-shipping and that squadron had lost.
Well, you see, the anti-shipping in the North Sea was a different proposition. In the first place, the bombs you had were a bit more primitive, and you used to attack them by flying very low and trying to get the bombs through the side, which was not a good thing. So this was, you know, fairly straightforward.